access number 28675, Mr. Eric Smith, Real 6. Now, so you're at Brandon Camp in Suffolk. What happens there? What sort of training are you doing to sort of stop, get you ready for D-Day?
Well, first of all, I spent a lot of time away.
What were you doing?
I went to Kirkcudbright in Scotland on ranges with these Cromwell tank, which we've been issued with.
Oh, so you've got the Cromwell there?
Cromwell been issued to us, that's right, yeah.
Now, tell me about that.
Pardon me, I'm not exaggerating, but that was a disaster. After the Sherman, we thought it was absolute rubbish. Badly armoured, got a 75mm gun, but it wasn't high velocity, you know, it wasn't a good gun. Undergunned, under-armoured. The only good thing about it was its mechanical reliability. It had got a Spitfire engine, a Meteor. And so we went to Kirkcudbright with them, on flats, took the tanks from Mildenhall to Kirkcudbright on the west coast of Scotland, and fired the guns out to the Solway of Firth to test them, you know, try them out. So we did 3 weeks in Kirkcudbright.
Just firing the guns or doing exercises as well?
No, just gun practice. That was February, towards the end of February. Did 3 weeks there altogether.
Just practicing gunnery.
Yes. The population were very welcoming. We had a wonderful time, and for the boys that really wanted the girlfriends, there was two big ICI factories, and at Kirkcudbright, Castle Douglas, and Del Beatty. So a good time was had by all. Really, we had a good 3 weeks there. Then we returned to camp, and then we were sent to, you may have never heard of it, but you might have done, it was called Longcross Halt, between Virginia Water and Sunningdale. It's still there as a camp. It's, when we were there, it was the FVPE, the Fighting Vehicle Proving Establishment. It's still there today, selling tanks and armoured things that we sell abroad as a demonstration area. Near Chobham Valley.
So it's in Surrey?
Surrey, that's right, yes.
Now, what were you doing there?
Well, testing tanks again. We did track testing. We used to drive all the way from there down to Basingstoke on the A30. We had 3 weeks there in a camp. And it was home from home. Beautiful sheets on the beds. Hot water bath if any of you wanted it. It was fantastic. We did 3 weeks there on this tank testing. The tanks would be stripped afterwards to see what wear had taken place, etc., etc. But here we are on the throes of the invasion. They were still testing them.
So that was in that March?
March, that's right, yes. 3 weeks in March, yes. So I spent very little time at the camp.
Most of the regiment was still back at...
Just the drivers went to Chobham, Longcross Halt. All the drivers of 22nd Armoured Brigade. At the end of 3 weeks, we were taken into a big dining hall. The top table like this was covered with top brass, red tabs. And I can remember there were two or three ATS girls taking notes. And they asked us what our opinion was of the Cromwell and Montgomery. And neither could be printed. We were scathing. We said it was like going into a boxing ring with your hands tied behind the back, the tank they were issuing us with. So there was no, honestly say, and it is in writing in books, there was no sort of spirit of in the division at all. Everybody was absolutely browned off. Yeah.
And so that wasn't getting any better?
No. It did give us another 10 days leave after the pressure in April. And then about the end of April, early May, we left the camp and went down on the River Orwell, which is a tributary to to Felixstowe, where we were going to sail from. And there we started waterproofing the tanks. We used to drive them in the river. And wherever the water came in, we would note it and then come out and put Bostik round the joints.
You were actually in Felixstowe?
In a little village called Nacton, Nacton.
And And so, anything about water? How did you actually waterproof? I mean, how did you stop the water coming in?
Well, there were bolted joints and welded joints, and where there was a leak, you put Bostik over, and that was all.
It was just Bostik?
Just Bostik, yes.
As we'd know today.
That's right, like tar, you know. Had a rubber shield around the gun to keep the water out of the gun emplacement. And on the back was a metal chute about 5 foot high from the exhausts. That was if you had a wet landing. All fixed up to the driver, the gun shield, etc. And if you went in fighting, you pressed a button and it blew all this protective thing off, you see.
Now, had the whole unit gone to Nacton?
Yes, whole unit, yes. I don't know where the rest of the division was, but they'd all moved down that area.
So what happened? This is April now.
Yes, we were early May when we went to Nacton, yes.
What next then?
Of course, we were in tents on the River Orwell. Discipline was very... It was a sealed camp. Nobody was allowed in or out. Camp R5, it was called. And although men did get out and were caught in Ipswich and so forth, but nevertheless it was a sealed camp. Your mail was all censored strictly, of course, because it was on the throes of D-Day. So we were there a week in May, we were there about three or four weeks.
And what? These security measures, I mean, you realised the importance, did you?
Oh yes, there was barbed wire all around the camp, etc. But I say, you had the odd character who still got, you know, like today, they always managed to get out some way. So we had quite and one or two of our, say, militant characters went into Ipswich overnight and had stolen bicycles and come back to camp with the bike. So the next morning on parade, the sergeant major said, "A bit of trouble in Ipswich last night. Some of you characters disobeyed orders and went into Ipswich, and the police are coming today to identify you. So those who took part, stay, don't come on parade." Oh, they were terrible, really. Not saying I was a good boy, but I hadn't got quite that sort of nature, you know, to do this. They were terrible. Feared nothing. I suppose they'd been through so much, they thought, well, they can't throw anything else at us. And they said, well, they put us inside, we should still be alive. Stick us in prison, it don't matter.
Now, what happened next then? You were there three weeks?
3 weeks altogether, yes. And then towards the end of May, we went down to Felixstowe by road with the tanks and loaded onto landing craft. About the 2nd of June, we got on landing craft because the invasion was scheduled for the 5th of June.
And this is a landing ship tank or?
A landing craft, yeah, small one, 5 tanks.
Oh, the small one, not the landing ship tank?
No, not the one we went to Italy on, that was LST. This was just an LCT. 5 tanks on a craft.
And what happened then? So that was the 2nd of June?
2nd of June. And of course, there were only no facilities for cooking or food. All we had was self-heating tins of soup and self-heating tins of cocoa. You pulled a little thing and it exploded inside and it came out red hot.
What about the soup?
Quite nice. Tomato Heinz, it was all, you know, quite an invention, of course, with these heat in it. The thing went down the centre of the can and it came out boiling hot. But of course, we only had enough on board for the journey. So as the invasion was delayed, lorries came and picked us all up again and took us back to the camp we'd left to get food. Eventually, we sailed on the afternoon of the 5th of June.
Now, what do you remember of the Channel crossing?
Well, we sailed out, as I say, from the River Orwell to Felixstowe, and then we hugged the coast all the way down to the Straits of Dover. And then Jerry opened up, obviously, we went through at dusk. Jerry opened up. Rumours had it that a craft was sunk, but I never heard it confirmed. But we sailed, and of course, with the interruption going through the Straits of Dover, where we should have landed when the tide was out, the time we got to Normandy, the tide was in. And I can recall it so vividly. We went into the beach. And
now, when did you go to the beach? What time?
About tea time.
On June the 6th?
On June the 6th, yes. We were supposed to be the second wave.
What do you remember of the landing?
Well, as I say, we got to the beach and the sailor got a fathom pole. And he dropped it in the water and he saw it's much too deep, even with your waterproofing. We've got you here. There's no point in drowning you. So they backed off the beach till the following morning. So we didn't come ashore until June the 7th. Then it was a dry landing, more or less. We landed in about 3 foot of water.
And whereabouts did you land?
Gold Beach. Next to the American sector.
And what was the situation when you landed?
Well, I often say it was a piece of cake compared to Salerno. A bit of firing and shells dropping, but they'd gone a mile or two inland already. And we sort of landed in comparative safety. There were bodies and vehicles knocked out here and there, blown up and craft laying about, but we proceeded from the beach inland about 2 or 3 miles to a village called Rays, R-Y-S, Rees, Rise.
R-Y-S?
R-Y-E-S, I think it was, Rees or Rise, yes. Went into these fields, and the first duty was to take off all this plastic around the gun and the chute at the back, and also drain the oil in case water got into the engine oil or sprockets. So we carried oil on the back of the tank, a couple of 5 gallon cans. So we changed the oil and got the tank ready for action. That was in the morning. And then in the afternoon, we went in to support the 56th Brigade, an independent infantry brigade, to help them to relieve pressure on the commandos who were at Port Embosson under pressure. So we went down there with the infantry to, that was, and only A Squadron was involved. Just
that's
our
on
one
the
squad.
8th, 8th of June.
The 7th, the afternoon of the 7th,
still
yes.
Still 7th, right.
Yes, yes.
And this is in the port where?
Port Embosson, B-S-S-I-N, just along the coast, on edging on the American sector. Port Embosson.
And what happened?
Well, there was quite a skirmish there. We went in and the infantry was suffering. First time I'd worked close to the infantry. As we drove down the road, the infantry running on the side of the road. Here and now and again, one would roll over, poor devil. And we pushed into this village. When we got into the sort of middle of the village, there were the infantry with quite a number of German prisoners. And they had quite a skirmish there. But that was just that one action. We just did that particular action, then came back to the unit at night.
Were you under fire? Much fire yourself, your tank?
Yeah, quite a bit. Yeah, we shelled quite a bit and didn't encounter any tank fire, but anti-tank guns.
Were still in Roberts's tank?
Oh, yeah, still driving John. And to our left, I can always remember, it was a big chateau, and you could see Jerry's everywhere. And I remember saying to the lap gunner, the co-driver next to me, put a burst in those windows. You see the Jerry's? And the officer said, Smith, you're getting quite militant, he said. I said, well, I'm fed up with this so-and-so war. Let's get out. Oh, dear. Yeah, I'm still with John. Then, of course, the following day, we went in to support action on that front towards Tilly-sur-Sours. And the crew, as I say, you weren't supposed to do anything unless the officer ordered you. He was in charge. But the gunner spotted a tank moving along a hedgerow and fired without permission and came back and hit the operator and caught him in the face. So, of course, we had to reverse out of action and he was a casualty and get a replacement. Bit of an inquiry over it, but these things happen.
So they fired without, so the operator wasn't ready for it?
No, the gunner fired without being told. So, of course, otherwise, what happened? Of course, the gun, as you know, recoils, comes right back in the turret. But fitted on them, which had been on all tanks, was a frame behind the gun with a bag to take the empty shell case in. But it impeded getting the shell in. It's all speed, and when you're in action, it's quick. The one who can get it off quickest wins. So these were removed, so the gun could run backwards and forwards without any interruption at all. And he just caught the edge of his jaw. He came back to us latter part of the war, but.
Anything else in the attack on Tilly?
Tilly and then Hottot. We called it Hotspot. That was mostly infantry work, but not a lot of tank. Because under Hitler's orders, the tanks were withheld for a few days. He wouldn't let them go into the beachhead and thought it was We'll throw them back into the sea like little fishes, he said. You know, they won't stop. So we didn't have a lot of tank firing, but we supported the infantry. Shelled a lot. He was shelling us intensively. Very unpleasant, but not so much for us as infantry outside. The odd burst of machine gun we'd fire for them or support them in different things, but it was like no advance. It was all, you know, yard by yard.
So what next?
Well, that went on more or less all the time. We moved about the bridgehead. Oh, our next do, of course, was a week later on the 13th of June when we went to Villers Bocage. We were on the next to the American sector and they found a weakness. So we were pushed through one evening and leaguered up outside this town, Villers Bocage. And next morning, the lead regiment was the City of London Yeomanry. And they went into the village and no sign of Jerry. But before anything else happened, this Whitman, this famous tank man, German tank man Whitman, appeared on the scene, and the tanks were strung out down the road. He knocked out the last one, and then knocked out about 28, one after the other.
This is an anti-aircraft or a tank man?
A tank man, a Tiger tank, yeah. Whitman was his name. He got 118 kills to his credit from Russia. A formidable tank. Well, you've seen a Tiger, obviously. Formidable weapon. It was imperious to anything we fired at it. It just bounced off. Even firing at a short range, it didn't penetrate, just bounced off. So he got a wonderful tank and confidence, of course, which it gives you when you've got superior equipment. So we had about 3 days there. They COIs were destroyed, more or less. Colonels, hundreds were put into the prisoner, taken prisoner.
And
we were up on, we were in reserve battalion on the high ground, but he was shelling. It was guns were firing over open sights. That's how close it all was. It was pretty terrifying. And then they decided that there was no, we were going to get Jerry getting the upper hand. There was no good staying there. So orders came to withdraw. But before we withdrew, a force of bombers were sent in and flattened the village that we'd been fighting for. And under the cover of darkness and the bombing raid, we were retreated. What infantry were left jumped on the back of the tank and we made our way out. Back to the bridgehead. So it was a disaster, really. And so what with the division already being in disarray, and of course destroyed Montgomery's faith in us completely. We were never used again for a main operation.
So, I mean, they really had done that much damage to the division's reputation.
Oh, yes, very much so, yeah. Yes, Monty, I've got a book there. Monty was really dismayed by the division, yes. Had a very bad name. Never again were we given a lead role.
Now, so what's the next thing you remember after that disaster?
Well, we come back to the bridgehead. And for replacements and reinforcements. And unbeknown to us, the NCO came round. He said, right, you. Half the unit was sent to the Pioneer Corps. Unfit for further fighting service. Bomb happy. And we got more reinforcements.
And how did that affect morale?
I don't think it was sunk any lower than it was, really. Nobody got a stomach to fight. There was no... Chaps did what they had to do to a certain point, but in fact, if I told you last time you were here, one lad who's died now from Stevenage, he joined us as a young recruit when we came back from Italy, and he said he'd come from a training regiment where discipline, of course, when you're training is strict and you obey every order. And into Normandy, about their second action, it came up on the air, the sergeant reported Tiger tank. So the colonel came up over there and said, prepare and get to engage. And it, without switching his intercom, and it went across the whole regiment, not effing likely, drive a reverse. Now this was a few days after we'd landed. That's how things were, you know.
So what you lost half your men. What were the new? What about the new drafts?
How new lads, 18-year-olds. Yes.
How did they fit in?
Oh, quite well, really. Yes. We were only conscripts, so we took to them well, really. Some nice lads.
And was their morale any better?
Well, they were keyed up full of until we sort of spoilt them.
You think you did spoil them then?
Well, I meant, Duff Gem, we were giving them. It didn't give them much heart to go and fight. And when you come across a field with about 20 Cromwells all burnt out, it doesn't lift your spirits very high.
So what next?
But they were good lads. They all mucked in and filled a role. Well, then it was, of course, fighting all the way through for about till August, 3 months. We were switched about the front all the time, different operations. Caen, Caumont, Falaise.
Now that's the breakout, Falaise.
That's when we were closing up to Jerry at Falaise, yes.
Now what's the next?
Hill 112. Fierce fighting all round there all the time, under shell fire. Still a bridgehead, not very deep. So we were everybody was under shell fire the whole time. I say our only saviour was the Typhoon aeroplane.
So these operations were. Is this the breakout or when you've broken out?
Well, there was the Operation Epsom, Battle of Epsom, when Montgomery thought he could break through.
No, you weren't in that, were you?
No. But that was infantry, of course. They were, I think, the 15th Scottish Division, which were new, had only just been blooded. I think they lost 5,000 men in a few days. Infantry suffered terribly. We were lucky.
Now, what about the value of the Typhoon? Can you comment on that a bit?
Well, we... not that I knew it at the time, but one of the tanks had an RAF officer in the turret. And in the bridgehead, being restricted and no aerodrome, which is what they wanted to capture, an aerodrome for support, they'd laid wire mesh. And these Typhoon squadron came over and they operated from this mesh. And this RAF officer, one in each regiment, would get in touch with the airstrip and say there's Tigers or 88mm guns, immediately they would scramble, and a flight of three would come over, and we had red smoke on board. We'd fire red smoke on the target, and then they'd dive in, and a Tiger turret would sail into the air about 20 foot. Six rockets they fired, they reckoned they were equal to a broadside from a destroyer. As they fired, you saw the plane shoot back, the force. They were fantastic. They saved our lives, definitely. Without the RAF, we would never have stayed ashore.
Now, what happened next then that you remember? What's the next action that you remember? I mean, I tell it gets a bit of a blur with all these different actions, but what's the next thing you remember?
Well, say, we sort of supported the Canadians at Caen, at Caumont, an aerodrome, pardon?
Anything you remember about that?
Apart from being shelled and we didn't have any tank action, I can remember. We supported them with shell fire, and they were mortared and blown about terribly. Corpses everywhere, poor old Canadians there. That was on the outskirts of Caen. But that's how it was, really. You change fronts day to day and really didn't know what was going on in a certain extent. I think we learnt more from the BBC when we listened at night on the radio. It's a war on your front, isn't it? But it was going all the time. We hardly had a break at all. Three months hard fighting, day and night.
What was it like under shell fire? You haven't really mentioned what it was actually like. I mean, what was German shell fire like?
Pretty bad, yes. Yeah, he had some good guns. He had the 88, which was the master gun. Then he had the 75s and the 105, very heavy guns. And I say the whole... Being a bridgehead, he could dominate it, really. And he was at this high ground, which we call Hill 112. And the one who owns Hill 112 dominates Normandy. Of course, there was some bitter fighting. That changed hands time and time again, Hill 112. Mostly infantry work and tanks. But we didn't take part in Hill 112 at all.
What was it like being in a tank when shell fire was going on around you? I mean, did you realise it was going on?
Oh yes, it shook the tank and smell of cordite and that. But I mean, we were immune really, unless you had a direct hit. In fact, on the outskirts of Falaise, we were supporting infantry, and he shelled towards the end then, of course, he was shelling awful. And our tank, not that we knew it, but he'd shelled all night. Goodness knows how the poor old infantry got on. But in the morning, John Roberts said to me, what's the matter? He said, the tank's on a bit of a slope. When we got out, because the wheels, the bogey wheels in the track, are only soft metal. They'd all been blown off. There were no wheels left. So we had to wait the fitters come up and put new wheels on, yes.
Now, what about the breakout and advance? That's fillets, the advance through fillets. And what about the breakout advance?
Well, again, it was pushing on. You know, the Canadians had taken a beating, and the first time the Poles had been used in any tank warfare, they'd been knocked about very badly. We were sort of pushing up all the time, but mostly shell fire. And, of course, air. We dominated the air. The noise was tremendous, and the smell. They reckoned even in the aeroplanes they could smell the stench of death. It was an awful experience.
During the advance?
Well, the actual at fillets, yes. Till the breakthrough came. Of course, the Yanks had broken through, hadn't they? And Jerry was on the retreat. But pretty terrifying, really. Memories fade, but it was awful, really. But say how lucky we were to be inside with ordinary shellfire. Unless you get an AP and an armour-piercing hit, you're pretty immune.
So what happened next? You're advancing through fillets. What could you see as you advanced through the fillets gap?
Well, smoke, bombs, burning vehicles, dead horses. I've never seen so many in all my life. Because Jerry, although he was such a advanced mechanised army, he used all horses extensively. They were laying everywhere, hundreds of horses. Legs in the air and the smell. And of course, at times you drove over them, you know, and the smell in your tracks of, awful, really. Okay, how many lost thousands, didn't he, at fillets? It extracted enough to cause us problems afterwards, of course, but then towards the end of fillets, of course, we'd been. We were out sent on this operation, and I think I said to you before, Jerry broke through over the infantry, and we were surrounded.
And what was that?
Pardon?
Where? When?
Well, towards Falaise, early August. I don't know the name of the place, but we were surrounded, and out of about 27 tanks that night, only five survived. Five.
What do you remember of that? I mean.
Well, driving down the lanes, and bazookas mostly, not tanks. He was sitting in the hedgerows, and of course the side of a tank is thin, no thick armour on the side, and he was destroying. Four in front of me went up in flames.
So he's a Panzerfaust?
Yeah, Panzerfaust, that's right, yeah. Very effective weapon.
And that was what was causing most of the casualties?
Then, yes, we were trapped, yes. He more or less ambushed us. And this John Roberts, I think I said to you before, had been wounded by then. And I'd got a sergeant who'd gone bomb happy, wouldn't get off the turret floor. And we got an officer who'd lost his tank, Jackie Garnett. He came onto our tank.
What was he now?
He was he'd been an ordinary soldier and been, been to Otchu and commissioned.
What was he like? How do you compare with...
He was death of glory. He was all for having a go. Let's get in there and, you know, that's what we're here for. Kill him. Old Jackie was a man full of... quite frightening to drive at times. Well, I think we'll have a go at them. I think, oh, for goodness sake, you know, let him rest. Not an aggressive spirit.
But was he a good tank commander? I mean,
He only came on the tank that day when we'd lost Roberts. No, lost the sergeant. Sergeant Atkinson had gone bomb happy. And he'd lost his tank, Garnet, so he came on our tank. So I only had him for that day. And then at night, Jerry, there were, I forget how many tanks left in this field, and Jerry was moving up on them. While we were sort of sitting there, a Sherman Firefly went up in flames, then a Cromwell. So Jackie came to me, or spoke to me, and he said, what do you think, Smudger? He said, if we stop here, we're either dead or prisoners. Let's have a go to break out. Are you game? I said, oh, yes. So honestly, he sat on the outside of the tank with his arm for support round the gun barrel, and we just drove like hell. and the four or five tanks that are left followed.
So he did well there.
Yes, drove out until we met one of our outposts, and at this, I think I said to you, this year at the dinner, our regimental dinner, we'd had the meal, and Major Cobain, who organised it, got up and he said, well, in August 1944, A Squadron, A and B Squadron were trapped. Jerry overran the infantry and we were ambushed. He said, and the order came out to break out. And he said, amongst you tonight is the man who volunteered to drive the first tank out, Eric Smith. Glory late. It was more fear than about courage. Oh dear.
What happened?